This is the Seahawkers Podcast, episode 356. I'm Brandon Schultz of the Military Seahawkers, and joining me, my good buddy and Montana Seahawker, Adam Emery.
Is there anything that's going through your head other than Colt freaking McCoy? Because that's all that I've had going through my head since Sunday.
I just recorded the show with Clinton the other day, and I forbade him from saying the words Colt McCoy for the entire podcast because, yes, the same exact thing has been happening to me.
Yeah, it's definitely frustrating.
Two years in a row. And the thing that made it worse was whoever that jerk was that put out the tweet that said that Colt freaking McCoy is the only quarterback, Seahawks quarterback or otherwise, to have a win at Lumen Field in 2020 and 2021. The only one.
Yeah, that's tough to swallow. I mean,
because you think, wait a second, that doesn't make any sense. But Russ has not won at Lumen Field yet this year.
Right. The home record has been a bit abysmal. And then with him missing games as well, that certainly didn't help. And then the idea that a Pete Carroll team has now lost to two different Colt McCoy led offenses that really did just kind of take their defense apart. And I mean, it'd be one thing if it was Colt McCoy with the Cards with an 8-2 record twice, right? Like, yeah. But this is once with a dumpster fire Giants team and now once with a pretend contender in the Cardinals.
Well, it leads me to a question that I have been bumping around in my brain. You can always tell, and you're on the lookout for signs when a team quits on their coach or a player quits on their team. Like, I feel like those signs are a little more obvious. What if the coach has given up on his team? What are those signs?
Well, that's interesting. I just listened to Pete's Monday presser. Yeah. And it was an interesting listen because he was asked a lot about the offense and things of that nature. Asked a little bit about Tyler's comments, which I'd really like to get into because I think those are very prescient. And he was extremely defensive, I felt like, even in his jovial Pete Carroll way. And, you know, it kind of went back to multiple times of him being like, well, you know, we know exactly what needs to be fixed and we know how to fix it, but the players need to execute. And I mean, did the whole team feel the both axles go right over top of their backs? Like, cause he drove the bus right over him in that presser. And that was tough. That was really tough to hear.
It's an odd turnaround from a coach on Sunday night who walked out of a press conference and came back and said that he didn't have any answers. Now, maybe he didn't mean I don't have any answers for the media in that regard, but it almost felt like the way he was saying it is that he didn't have any answers as to how to solve things. We kind of beat on Pete a little bit for, you know, not being that progressive stats guy where you go for it on fourth down in certain situations. But Pete Carroll is a stats nerd. He is, because he came in that press conference and said, well, we're not turning the ball over. Where, and he points to his stats, the turnover
stats.
There
you go. There you go. I really wanted to get to that because you're 100% right. He points to his stats.
He has his he's big on third downs, yeah, on both sides of the ball, which makes a lot of sense. Turnovers makes a lot of sense. There's one other one that it's not coming to my mind right now, but penalties. He pointed at penalties. It's like, oh, well, we only had a couple penalties in this game. The problem was, your team didn't score any points, Pete. That's the biggest stat. That's the stat that matters.
Right. And look, back in the past, in the history of the NFL, those are the things, if you win at those stats, you generally win. And so you can understand Pete's legit confusion when it comes to the fact that the results aren't even close to being there, especially the last two games. I mean, earlier in the season, I think we could all agree that those were very close losses and, you know, just a little bit of a break here or there and everything's a little different. But I think that's the perplexing part to him is that, and it's especially the turnovers. I mean, he is so turnover focused, and I agree with that. I think it's a great idea to try to create turnovers and obviously not cough up the ball yourself. I mean, having a good turnover differential is a winning formula in many ways. There's no doubt about it. But there's definitely been a shift in his mindset. And one of the things that really stood out to me from the presser on Monday was about halfway through, they were asking him about the team and third downs and all that and some of his stats. And his big thing was, well, we all know that whichever team makes the fewest mistakes is the one that usually wins going down the stretch, just making the fewest mistakes. And right there, that shows you that's just a totally different mindset than kind of where he was at earlier on as his tenure here as the Seahawks coach, that you had to compete, you had to take chances. Like now it's, well, if we just mitigate all the risk, then we'll come out on top. And that highly, I'm going to say scared way of coaching is manifesting itself this season. And it's not only, we talked about this a little after the game, but it's not only on the offensive side of the ball. It's, well, the risk management screwed up all the way around. And it's funny because on the offensive side of the ball, there's too much risk in not enough just taking what's there. And then on the defensive side of the ball, it's too much vanilla and bend but don't break. And so you're kind of going about it all wrong on both sides of the ball. And no doy, you're going to be freaking 3-7.
Well, and that's why I had that thought. Now, I'm not saying that necessarily that Pete has quit on this team, but in the sense that if you're not allowing your team to take the kind of risks that really you need to be able to take to win, I'm starting to lean that way, that he's kind of maybe not giving up on his team is the right way to put it, but that's just, it's where my mind kept going. And yeah, the defensive thing, again, to bring up Colt McCoy's name, when you give any player, tight end, wide receiver, running back, a 5-yard cushion all around him, right in the center of the field, and you don't expect Colt to go there every single time. Those first two drives where you gave up 10-minute drives by your defense and just allowed them to go straight down the field by just playing pitch and catch with the open guy in the center of the field, that's how this team got dominated in this game.
You leave that guy open by 5 yards, and then you're also only rushing 4. Like, I get it if you're bringing an extra blitzer or 2, right, and getting aggressive and trying to stop this drive in its tracks. Like, okay, sure, you're going to have a guy that's open by a few yards, but you're banking on the pressure getting there beforehand and affecting the throw or causing a sack. Well, if you don't do either, if you don't cover well, and then you don't blitz, and you don't get any pressure on the quarterback, then what are you doing on defense? Except for just watching the fellow or your opposing or your opponent just dink and dunk all the way down the field the way that the Cardinals did. And the maddening part about it is this is how today's NFL is being played defensively. I mean, we've talked about it ad nauseum since last year. It's the too high shell stuff that's been screwing with all of the quarterbacks that like to push the ball downfield. It's been screwing with all of them. And you saw Colt McCoy and the freaking Cardinals execute 10, 12 play drives by just taking what's there. And you're like, if Colt McCoy can do that, how is it that Russ can't consistently do that? Why are we always taking that extra layered shot? And you got to do it sometimes to keep the defense honest. And I get all that. But at some point, like, you can't keep forcing the ball into double coverage deep down the field. People killing DK for not coming up with that long ball. And it's like, what are you talking about? That was a 3% chance that he could make that catch at best. That was a catfish decision and a catfish throw. And he did the same thing the week before to Tyler, force it in the end zone. I'm just sick of seeing that when you got dudes leaking out of the backfield, guys you could hit quickly, start to alleviate the fact that this offensive line is terrible at pass protection and take what the defense is giving you. And they're all pointing to the third down numbers. And they're like, well, we got to do better on third down. We got to do better on third down. That's the deal. That's what's keeping us all from going down the field. Well, the long and short of it is it really doesn't much matter what the third down percentages are. That's not the point. The point is that you're not playing to the weaknesses of the defenses that you're being presented with. And you see the successful teams, including the Chiefs are a great freaking example of this, getting their butt handed to them by this too deep shell coverage and finally realizing, oh, Patrick Mahomes is like, you know what? I don't have to be freaking Superman on every other play. Just check it the frick down. And yes, it's frustrating. Yes, it takes patience. Yes, it's hard on your ego if you're one of the top passers in the league. But ask Tom Brady how that works out over catfish time. Just do it. And it's so maddening to see them do that, because if you stay ahead of the chains, take all those dink and dunks, now those third downs are much more convertible. Now you're more on the field. Keeps your stupid catfish defense off the field that can't get itself off the field. It's all anti-complimentary football. I'm catfish sick of watching it. And I'm so mad that I'm this mad. You know, like, it's 3-7. 3-7. We haven't had to do this podcast. I thought I was going to be chill today. Started out that way in this podcast. But as I sit and think about this last catfish game, this is where I'm at.
We are in uncharted territory for this show again. I mean, how do we operate when this team is out of the playoffs halfway through the season? I don't know. We've never had to do this before. And you know, the thing that it leads me to another one of Pete Carroll's favorite stats that he loves to look for, and it is explosive plays. If we don't have four or five explosive plays in a game, we're not going to win. And it's focusing in on these certain stats that he has been accustomed to over the years that's now leading the philosophy on both offense and defense that ends up, like you said, playing it safe on defense and then not playing to the point of taking what's being given to you by the opposing defense.
Yes, it's death by a thousand cuts on defense because you're too worried about the freaking explosives. Look, if you're facing Colt McCoy, guess what I'm going to live and die with? His ability to push the ball down the field to ancient AJ. Okay? Like, D-Hop wasn't even there.
That's why he's not a starting quarterback.
That's exactly right. So why do we play defense in that particular game specifically in a way that accentuates Colt McCoy's strengths, which are decision-making and getting the ball out quickly? That's what he's good at after being in the league for, you know, 13 years or however long it's been. The game plan makes no sense. And I guess that's where it gets to Tyler's comments for me. Like, he is such an understated guy, and he definitely doesn't, he's all about the protect the team mentality, and he's not looking to throw dudes under the bus. But I mean, at some point when Tyler Lockett comes out and goes, yeah, well, we're seeing one thing on film. We go out and we start playing and we see another thing. And I don't know, I guess, we're slow to adjust, and like, you know, tries to kind of like cover it up like he's not taking a shot, but shots fired. And it's obvious to everybody that, no, this team does not adjust well. I mean, how long did it take him to cover Zach Ertz?
Did they ever?
There you go. Like, if you're really worried about the explosives, that's the guy to cover. AJ Green was dink and dunking you to death, but Ertz was killing you downfield. I mean, how often are you going to, you know, throw linebackers on these guys and not play more dime and see more Ryan Neal on the field, not to be sending Jamal a little bit more on blitzes and or Bobby? How come we're not running stunts up front? How come everything is so vanilla? And really, at the end of the day, is I sat and I thought about this. Dude, the problem with this team, and I've been harping on this, you've been harping on this for years, it's in the trenches. We're all worried so much about explosives, and you can't have and or prevent them without real dudes in the trenches. And we went into this offseason being like, well, what's it going to be like having a bunch of BB plus dudes on the defensive line? Is that going to be a winning formula? Turns out, not so much. You're going to be good against the run, and you can't get to the quarterback. What happens when you have one great player and then a bunch of B and C dudes on the offensive line? You end up with being able to block for the running game pretty well, but you can't pass protect. It's the catfish trenches.
Yeah, and you brought up Ryan Neal, who played 11 snaps of the 83 on defense. And you wonder why Zach Ertz blew up in this game. And the other guy, Carlos Dunlap, 17 snaps, 20%. He's been a massive disappointment this year. So the guy that I think we were counting on to have kind of a at least continue the type of year that he had in the second half last season has been MIA, essentially.
Yeah, I mean, he was the difference maker, seemingly, at the end of last year. And maybe Father Time has caught up to Carlos Dunlap. I don't know. But yeah, the amount of snaps that he's playing continues to decrease, and his effectiveness doesn't seem to be increasing. So this is a very broken team, and it really does start at the top. I mean, after losing twice to Colt McCoy, I think I'm finally warming up to the idea that maybe it's time. Maybe it's time to move on from Pete. Like, and that's hard for me to say.
Maybe. I know that I can't have a weekly debate over who needs to be fired, though, for the rest of the season. I can't do that week to week throughout the rest of the regular season.
Okay, so hold off on that talk till we're watching the playoffs.
I don't know. I mean, we can talk about it now if you want. We'll probably get into some email here that we'll bring on some of that discussion. Why don't we go to Scott, who says, "Hi, guys. All I can say is this is completely unacceptable on every level from every person at the club. Currently, we are the second worst team in the NFC, just ahead of the Lions. Yes, the catfishing Lions. It's unbelievable how bad they have become. I just can't get my head around what I and we are watching every Sunday. It's time. Time to blow it up and start over. And I don't think anyone should be safe of staying. They all stink." From Scott. Sorry, I forgot to add the worst thing of all. They are catfish boring. Thanks for letting me get that off my chest. Try and have a great week, and thanks for all you do.
Yeah, Scott ain't wrong, especially on the defensive side of the ball. They're freaking boring.
On the offense, they are too. This game was a boring game.
Yeah, I mean, there wasn't a lot of big plays downfield, that's for sure. No, part of it is too that, I don't know, the Chris Carson injury, I think, makes a big difference in this offense overall. And then I guess it was just frustrating, too. Like, you're struggling in the passing game and, you know, you can't seem to stop a stunt for up front for the life of you, especially on the right side. And so instead of leaning on the run game, which had been pretty dang effective, especially when you're running between the tackles with Alex Collins, which we've talked about ad nauseum for weeks, seemingly now. They do it for a minute, and then they get away from it. Like, take some pressure off.
How frustrated was Pete Carroll after the game, talking about Rashad Penny running it for one time, one carry, has a big carry, and has a hamstring injury?
Who's responsible for him still being on the roster? Is it Schneider or is it Pete?
I don't know.
Because there's so many of these guys that we have suffered through over the years. I mean, LJ Collier is another one right now. Like, what are we doing?
CJ ProSize, where you keep him on, and then you wait. Essentially, you're waiting until the end of his contract is over. I feel like it is. I think it's on Pete. I think it has to be on Pete because, for one, he cares so deeply for the players, I think, that he's not willing to move on when it's guys that he really does feel something for and believes in their potential.
I don't think he has a problem getting rid of dudes based on performance if it's just a performance thing, like mental thing. Yeah, but if it comes down to injuries, you can't just look at health as being a part of talent, right? Like, it's one of the, you can run fast, you can jump high, you've got a good mental IQ, and staying healthy is a part of talent. And Rashad Penny is not a healthy player. Period. End of story. And should have been off this roster two seasons ago. We should have had another back that is capable on this roster beyond Alex Collins. I mean, obviously we had Chris Carson at the beginning of the season, but I mean, another backup.
Yeah.
I would have rather had Carlos Hyde again this year. Like, why? Where do these decisions get made? Who's making them? Is it Schneider or is it Pete?
There needs to be an answer in terms of accountability. And
how long are we going to stick with Ethan Posick? How long? Like, how long do you stick with a guy who's barely mediocre at best?
You brought up another issue talking about the trenches. and the inability to handle stunts, especially when it's Chandler freaking Jones who crushes your team every single time that you play him. How do you not have an answer for Chandler Jones?
I don't know. I don't understand either how they run that same stunt about four times in the game, and every single time it looked like Gabe Jackson started to bump out to the interior player that was looping around, and then you watch, you know, Chandler Jones loop around the other side and right up the freaking A-gap.
Yeah, where was like, Posick on those plays, though? Was he was he focused on the left side of the line with the other two?
Look that way.
Why do you not focus more toward the direction of Chandler Jones?
I don't know.
Travis Homer was so focused on Chandler Jones on the second play of the game that he puts a hand on him before even turning to look at the linebacker who's blitzing off the edge and comes clean at Russell Wilson and just has a free sack.
Yeah.
That's how focused he was on Jones.
Well, I guess the offensive line definitely bears a lot of responsibility here. And look, let's give Dwayne Brown some credit. I mean, for playing less than 100% out there and not giving up any pressures, I believe. I think he played a pretty clean game.
Yeah.
So let's give Dwayne Brown credit, because when I criticize the offensive line, I want to make the caveat almost every time. The offensive line, except for Dwayne Brown. Like, that's the one dude I don't want to throw into the bus, right?
Yeah. Well, he had a rough game last week, and he had a rough game against the Vikings. And other than that, he's done okay.
Well, he's done very well. Yeah, otherwise, he's very consistent. And that's the problem. You talked about the explosives earlier and how Pete like wants to live and die by the explosives. You know what's not consistent? Explosives. That's a hard thing to be consistent at, especially when the other team knows that's all you want to do. I don't understand. Like, the consistency of quick slants. You know, how many times did the Cardinals run just little hitches, just little hook routes that were 7 yards deep? Run the DB off, run a hitch, boom, ball on time, away you go. There's no way for the defense to even get to the quarterback at that point. So where are these? Where are these plays? You're telling me DK can't body up dudes on hitches all day? You're telling me Tyler's not shifty enough to shake a dude on a quick slant? How do we have no option routes for guys like maybe D. Eskridge? How does he barely even see the field? Like, I just don't get it. I don't get, like, the idea that you can't take the easy, consistent stuff, that you can't do it. And then just have an inability to run screens. So I don't know. Maybe at the end of the day, it does fall back on Russ, because that felt a little like what Pete was saying in his presser on Monday.
That could be. I don't know. And maybe he's to the point of having explained this to Russ, that this is how they're going to have to adjust to be able to win, or at least consistently move the ball down the field, at least to give the defense a freaking break after it gave up two 12 plus or 10 plus play drives in the first half and just gassed the defense the entire first half. I don't put the first half on the offense at all, because it was, well, other than the fact the inability to score within the red zone because you're throwing fades to DK Metcalf in the end zone instead of running real plays. But the defense's ability or inability to get off the field. And a part of that is, again, the strategy of it. So there's nobody on this team that I can say doesn't deserve some blame. And that includes Russ.
Well, and a little bit of it too is Russ is trying to play like he's 26 still, continuing to loop back, rely on his legs, do all that stuff. And he can do that a little bit still. Absolutely. Like, it's not like he's a statue at this point in his career, but he's also not the same quick twitch athlete in that manner as everybody that is when they age. Like, he's got to learn to play differently. He's got to be more patient. You want to be great? Look at what the great ones have done. I'd say most people would say the debate between the greatest quarterback of all time falls between Tom Brady and Joe Montana. Probably, yeah. Right? I would say most people probably land there. Okay, what are they most known for? Throwing deep shots?
Nope,
it's the exact opposite. It's for making the Wes Welkers of the world a quadrillion dollars because he learns how to, you know, work with a dude on an option route.
Yeah, that's frustrating. Chad Hawley is frustrated, says, so 24 hours later, I believe I can put together an opinion that isn't completely emotional and reactionary, mostly. That's good. Good for you, Chad, because, you know, what are we? How many days out are we?
we're still feeling the feels.
Still feeling it. I don't believe we have a complete failure of the skill on the roster. What I do feel is that about 25% of the roster should probably not be on the team. Pete Carroll's being a player's coach. He tends to give players far too many chances. See, we were just talking about this. I think this is a residual from his time as a college coach. It's not that he needs to be one of those coaches who yells and screams at his players. It just doesn't appear that he holds the players accountable enough for doing what is asked. If player A can't do the job, then he needs to put in a player that can. Many times, he treats the players like children that need constant encouragement and 4 to 5 chances to come around. These are supposed to be professionals. At a certain point, you can either do it the way you ask or not. Pete is a great coach for year 1 and 2 players and maybe even older veterans, but he does not seem to have the skills to work with players at year 3 and 4 when you're either an NFL player or just a really good college player. I like Pete and everything he has done for this team, but I think now he may even realize that this is his weakness. Go Hawks, from Chad.
Go Hawks, Chad. I think this is something that manifests itself the most obviously in terms of Russ. I mean, we've been talking about him being impatient and not checking it down for almost 2 full seasons now. How has this message not gotten through? Or is it a message Pete's not communicating at all? I mean,
I wonder, because of the explosives that he knows Russ can get those explosive plays, and it's explosives that get the wins. That's the stat that he's looking for.
And that's fine if you're doing the rest of the game consistently. And that's not what this team is right now. They need to focus on doing the little things consistently.
It takes some of those little things to be able to set up those explosive plays consistently.
Well, okay. And this is the other part that I wanted to get to in terms of, well, you just want him to check down all the time. What are you going to do? Make this into an Alex Smith offense? Is this going to be dink and dunk all freaking day? Absolutely not. When you have somebody like Russ, you can dink and dunk your way down the field until you suck the safeties back up into the box. And now you set up the deep shots. Right now, it's about sequencing, I think, is really what the problem is. Is there, in the past, they were able to, you know, set up the run game and the short stuff by taking those deep shots early in the game and connecting and making the defense have to defend every square inch of the field right out of the gate, right? And then you can do all the easy stuff after that, coast your way to the fourth quarter, make one more explosive, boom, you win the game. It's not where we're at now.
And this is another reason why I have a hard time putting any of this on Shane Waldron. Because this is the third offensive coordinator with Russ, and nothing has changed. So maybe none of the issues ever were on offensive coordinators.
That's an interesting thought. It had crossed my mind. I guess the other thing that had crossed my mind is that I'm watching the Rams struggle mightily with their offense right now, and the patriarch of this entire offense having problems because the league is like, okay, I get it. I get mainly what you want to try to do. And, you know, the Rams are struggling as well. So maybe that's part of the deal, is that, you know, the league has kind of figured out exactly how it is they want to defend this offense.
Well, that goes back to Tyler's comment then. Another point that I wanted to make is that if you're preparing to face a team one particular way, based on what you see on film or based on what you see them doing primarily against other teams, and then every week a team is consistently doing something to your offense that they haven't done to others, it's because they've figured out your offense. It's because they know going into this game is that, oh, we just have to do what other defenses do against this team. Do the Seahawks not watch the past games of how other defenses have approached this team? Do they only watch how defenses approach the other opponents instead of how other defenses approach their offense?
A little bit of self-scouting, so to speak. I mean, I'm sure they do. But I guess this kind of points to your idea of, has it always been an OC problem? Or is this, you know, kind of a Russ issue? And Pete kind of alluded to this in the presser, too. You know, they were asking about the the Tyler comment, and he's like, well, that's assuming he's right, number one. Like, he throws Tyler right back under the bus.
Well, he did say that he hadn't heard it yet.
Right. And then the second thing that he said was, well, the teams have always played us differently because of the mobility of the quarterback and da-da-da-da-da-da. So is this not so much that, you know, they're playing the Seahawks specifically differently, or they've started to play Russ differently? I think they finally have all decided, all these DCs, they're like, no moonballs. We're not going to
play zone. We're not going to play man. And we're just going to defend everything deep.
Right. And if we play zone, then Russ can't run around, right? Because the defenders are facing the offense and they can watch Russ run and close in on him. And they're like, look, prove to us that you can beat us this way. Prove to us. You're going to have to do it. And Russ can't Colt McCoy his way down the catfish field.
It would appear so.
And still, the idea that they can't run a screen is freaking unacceptable. And also that they can't get Gerald Everett involved even more. I mean, he's been a monster out there. Also, the fact that they really don't play a lot of three wide. If that's what you're running this Rams offense and you're running it all through Russ, like, you got to play with a few more receivers out on the field with more consistency. Why don't they run any of those tight splits and confuse the defense? How come the receivers don't chip down on blocks all that often? I don't know.
There's a lot of questions there to go after. I'm going to go after the Gerald Everett one because I had that question too. When I think of a guy on the Seahawks offense right now, ever since Marshawn Lynch left, there's kind of been that missing piece of that guy who can be physical, fire up the sideline. I kind of hope that DK could be that, because to a certain extent, he does have that capability of being able to bowl over dudes. Gerald Everett is that guy. You get the ball in his hands and he is trying to go through everyone. And so you got to get it to him more. You got to find more ways, whether it's a screen, a little dump off. That guy is ready to go straight through other dudes. Yeah. And it is fun to watch.
It is. It's super fun to watch. And when he's wide open in the end zone, you got to get it to him. You can't miss.
Ugh. That was,
I mean, it's collective, you know, Russ being, no, he says he's totally fine and the ball's coming out of his hand just right and all that crap, but still missed three or four throws in this game that he doesn't characteristically miss, like, that were relatively easy. The Everett touchdown is definitely one of them. And then the offensive line not being able to pick up a stunt. Receivers with drops in key moments. I mean, Will Dissly had a big one on a third down.
DK had one that he could have had for a first down.
Yeah. On and on and on. It really is collective. And that does feel like an overall focus issue. And, you know, Pete alluded to that in his presser as well. And I don't know how you get that focus back, because it doesn't, let me put it to you this way, it doesn't feel like Pete's getting through to anybody right now.
And maybe we're just a week late to notice this, because Joseph Condon on Twitter at New F Guy, He tweeted at us after last week's show, said, shaking my head listening to this week's podcast. You guys are holding on to ghosts. This team is so broken. Russ should be traded as he will hold back the needed rebuild. Pete and John are toast. And I asked him to kind of explain that a little bit more. So he emailed in. Here's Joe's email. Says, here are my expanded thoughts on my Twitter comment. I believe the current version of the Seahawks is a broken team lacking talent depth, cap flexibility, and bereft of competent playoff-winning caliber coaching. The Pete and John show has depleted this team with multiple poor drafts and poor judgment when pursuing big-name trades, which expend needed draft capital. As you pointed out during the podcast, it's not clear who has more say on these trades between Pete and John, but I suspect it is Pete. He seems willing to gamble on these types of trades. The Harvin trade was unneeded given the strength of the 2013 team. The Jimmy Graham trade was also a loser, but the Adams trade will go down as a disaster, given the value of those lost first-round picks and Adams' barely above-average performance and lack of coverage skills. Russell Wilson is aging, and his weakness as a pocket passer is becoming evident. His avoidance of checkdowns and use of the middle of the field has been a chronic problem. His ego will not allow him to hang around for a rebuild. With so much salary cap tied up in Wilson, Wagner, and Adams, they will lose Diggs to free agency, Dwayne Brown is toast, and Wagner is fading as well. Metcalf will expect record money in a couple years. Carroll has been a good coach, but he has made too many glaring errors of judgment, the worst of which cost a Super Bowl victory. And life changes hard, and admitting the glory days have ended is even harder. I believe the best way forward is to change the head coach and GM and to trade Wilson while his value remains high. Just making the playoffs only to exit early isn't cutting it with the fans, and even that achievement is slipping away this season. Best wishes and happy Thanksgiving. The podcast is well done and entertaining. From Joe.
Appreciate it, Joe. I think we're closer to being where Joe's at after this week. And hey, everybody gets to where they get at certain points. I mean, I think both of us try to not be knee-jerk reactionary to everything. Like, let enough evidence roll through to really be able to form an opinion. I agree with a fair amount of that. The idea of getting rid of Russ and trading Russ. Right now, I'm not on board with that because I think with a coaching change and who knows, maybe GM as well. The jury's still out on Schneider to me in some ways. It feels like Russ could have a John Elway type ending to his career in Seattle. Like once John Elway, who played just like Russ plays in a lot of ways, right? Be able to run around, you know, make explosive plays out of nothing, you know, the rabbit out of your hat sort of thing, and have a lot of years of personal success and gone to a couple Super Bowls and never won one with a weak roster around him. Finally, at the end of his career, was like, yeah, lean on TD, take the easy throws, win a couple chips. So I'm not out on Russ to this point. But
that's gross, Adam. It's gross that you would bring up John Elway's name in relation to as a former AFC hated player.
I understand.
To compare him to Russ.
Yeah.
Even though that's something that I also did on our post game show that we did on the Wisdom app. That's disgusting.
Yeah. Well, if you say so, that's fine. But it does make sense. Yeah, I guess I probably did steal that point from you. Did you make that on that? Yeah. But what I need to see, and if we talk about what's coming up, what's going forward in this season, I mean, obviously they have to go undefeated to have a shot to even make the playoffs. So that's next to nothing. You can pretty much kiss that goodbye. There's still a slight chance, but I'm not holding on to it. But what I need to see for the rest of this year, I need to see if Russell's finger is a Kurt Warner thumb situation. I'm still not convinced. I need to see that. If we get towards the end of this year, and it looks like he's still struggling with just four or five simple throws a game because of that finger, I'd have an easier time parting ways.
Well, the thing is if you're seeing that, then you're definitely not going to get the kind of draft pick return that you would maybe need to look at a rebuilding situation. The problem I have, going back to Joe's commentary, is that if you are team blow it up to the point that Russ is gone, Pete's gone, the GM's gone, you're hoping for something that's not going to happen. Who's going to make the decision for everybody to go? If the owner comes in and says, okay, Pete's got to go and the GM goes, the GM that comes in probably doesn't want to start from ground zero.
Oh, yes, they do. Every new GM ever loves getting rid of everybody.
Even when you have a starting quarterback, what GM has come
in? Ask Cam Newton how it works. Ask Cam Newton how it works.
That felt like it was different because it was the end of Cam Newton went and hasn't had success, but then he got brought back. So hey, there you go.
I'm just saying, like, look at the Jets this last year. Look at almost every situation when a new GM comes in.
Oh, yeah. If they have a bad quarterback, they move on from the bad quarterback.
They have a bad team, they move on from the bad team. Like most GMs love starting from scratch.
Doesn't it seem more like a Russ or Pete decision rather than Russ and Pete?
Well, you asked who would make the decision to blow the entire thing up and fire everybody, right? You know who makes that decision in a lot of ways? It's Russ. What does he say after the end of this year? Does he demand his way out? Is all that stuff like really true? Or does he say, no, this is my football home. And sure, we're in a tough spot right now, but I don't run away from adversity. I'm rebuilding this thing. What does Russ do?
if I'm to believe Russell's comments at the end of his press conference that this is poised for a storybook type ending, that storybook style ending doesn't finish with him going to another team and winning a championship. Like, that would be a terrible thing for him to be thinking in his mind in terms of his best outcome for his story, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, that's possible. The other thing that we got to ask ourselves too, is that, we have this discussion, we'll get rid of Pete. All right. Who you got that's better? Oh, well, let's trade Russ. Okay. Who you got that's better? Like, I mean, that's a legit question you need to ask yourself when you're having these. And most people, because of the knee-jerk reaction of our society today, they are just, well, screw it, burn it down. All right, cool. Then what are you going
to
live in?
You know what? I have started to see more of that conversation. Maybe it's just because we point that out so often that it's people within our Seahawkers podcast, Ring of Honor, that said, well, what if you say, okay, Russ, you can go to Chicago now, but we want Justin Fields and we want some picks. Now, Chicago by now will probably know whether or not they want Justin Fields. And who knows, Matt Nagy may be gone. And maybe that ends up being the scenario that Seattle has an option for, because if Chicago changes that wholesale, maybe they decide that they don't want Fields and maybe they'd be willing to take Russ. Who knows?
I think that's a pipe dream. Like, if you think you're trading Russ for Justin Fields right now, that ain't happening.
Yes, trading that's why I go back to that idea of, because even in the situation that Aaron Rodgers was in, it sounded like the 49ers were willing to trade to get Rodgers to San Francisco, and that didn't happen. So I'm very skeptical on trades that sound good to us. Like, we can form a trade in our mind that, oh yeah, I would do that. But you have to think too, would the other team really do that?
Oh yeah. I mean, you gotta, like, for example, I saw somebody had tweeted and it got placed somewhere. Maybe it was in the Ring of Honor. Somebody brought it up, or I don't remember where I saw it, but basically it was some dude. He was asking a hypothetical to Broncos fans. Would you trade the entire draft a la Ricky Williams trade back with the Saints, right?
Mm-hmm.
For Russell Wilson right now, keeping in mind that there's a couple really choice picks in that draft. So I sent that to Bronco friend Jared, right? Like, because
who says
immediately,
no? Who says
immediately,
no?
Immediately, when I saw that, I was like, yeah, I would do that trade. I would do that trade if I was a Seahawks fan. I was like, yeah, if that's your gut reaction, oh, yeah, I would definitely do that trade. Best believe that when you ask somebody from the opposing fan base how they would feel about it, like I did Jared, their response is, oh, hell no.
Right.
So those deals aren't just there.
You have to find your friend that is a fan of the other team that would also say yes.
Yeah.
And that's a good way to measure it.
Bill O'Brien's not in the league anymore, so there's not too many dopes that you can just take advantage of in a super lopsided trade.
That's interesting that the Broncos would say that Jared would say no to that.
Oh yeah, that was a hard pass.
Is it because he's watched Russ here these last few games?
No, it's just the idea of trading an entire draft class, which is, that's a catastrophic thing for an organization. Like, trading an entire year's worth of picks, that's tough. And then on top of all of that, for a quarterback who's 32, coming off the worst injury of his career, to his throwing hand, are you interested?
You talk about how catastrophic that is, and it takes me back to this last draft for the Seahawks, where you get Dwayne Eskridge, who ends up injury impacting his season to the point that, yeah, he's played 11 snaps in this last game and has only had one touch in the last two games. You got Trey Brown, who gets injured in this game, covering AJ Green,
God,
is out for the season now. And now you have your sixth round pick. And that was their 2021 draft.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, you don't want to give up an entire class worth of draft picks.
No, but kind of the point of that was just like, yeah, a lot of people have these notions. Well, you just trade Russ and you get Zach Wilson back in a trade. Are we sure? I mean, if you're Scott Fitterer, like, who's intimately familiar with Russ, are you pulling the trigger on that deal? I don't know.
And the other thing is if the Jets have seen enough of Zach Wilson to say, oh yeah, we'll trade him, do you really want him?
Oh, sure. I don't care what the Jets think about anybody. Like, they don't know their, you know, elbow from their butt, you know, like
maybe they have money. Maybe that's true. Although they seem to know with Sam Darnold.
I guess eventually. Yeah. Yeah, it's a sticky situation. And then from the counter perspective, right? Okay, we're 3-7 this year. This is going to be our first losing season with Russ and Pete in a decade. Blow it up? Like one bad year out of 10? You 10% of your years have been bad years as a Seahawks fan. Blow it up? Is that knee-jerk?
And well, it's not knee-jerk in the sense of people who are kind of watching the trends, right? If it's trending downward, I think about that too, because I kind of want to see the redemption story of this. If it's the first losing season, the guys go into the workshop, they figure out what they need to do, they make all the moves they need to make in the offseason, they bring it all back next year, it works out. And, you know, here they are at the end of the season holding up the trophy. That's like the storybook ending. That's how I want the story to end.
That would be the most ideal way that it could all come together. That's for sure. And it's all going to start with Pete and Russ in this offseason. And because they asked Pete, I think Michael Sean Dugar asked him, like, are you and Russ on the same page going forward? And Pete danced around it. Well, I mean, you know, we're focused on this week. We're on the same page for that. Dot, da, dot, da, dot, da, dot. Because if Pete and Russ look at each other at the end of this year and Pete goes, you know what? I need to change this, this, and this, and this. And like, really does it. And then Russ says, you know what? I was injured for 3 games and beyond subpar for another 2. So for 5 games, nearly half the season, I wasn't at my best, and I owe this city and this fan base and my, you know, coaching staff, like, the loyalty to be back this next year and really go after it. Then maybe it all does get run back one more time.
I can't get behind the idea that that discussion happens after the season. That discussion needs to happen now. Just like the meeting with the defense after losing to the Cardinals. Why is that happening now? Why is the defense just now deciding that they need to get together and have a meeting after they're essentially out of it for the year? No, this is a conversation that Pete and Russ need to work through now so that, you know, maybe one of them gets a little bit what they want in a certain game. They're seeing if it works. They need to use this second half of the season to work through those issues, to figure out where, if they're going to bring it back next season, what pieces they're going to pick and choose to work and really believe and feature in the following season.
What does winning football look like for a Pete and Russ marriage in 2022? That's what they need to figure out.
That's what they need.
And that's a great point, Brandon. I hadn't thought about it in those terms, but, you know, because you get to 3-7, right? And you're basically out of it. And look, if you don't want to watch a lot of the games going forward, folks, like, I get it. Like, it gets tough. So like, what are you watching for? Like what's interesting then going forward? And that's a great thing to watch and great thing to look for. Do they take Tyler's comments to heart? Does Russ, you know, change his style a little bit? Does his finger look fine? Does Pete actually, you know, get more aggressive on defense? Because at this point, catfish, what do you have to lose?
Yeah. Why play it safe for the rest of the season and allow teams to dink and duck you to death?
I don't know.
Why would you do that?
I don't know.
Starting with this team coming up, with the Washington football team. Because Taylor Heinicke, I know he can make those Colt McCoy throws.
Yeah, and he can make a few wild throws here and there, too. I mean, Heinicke's fun. Heinicke's fun to watch. The Washington defense, not as quite as good as we all thought going into this year. And with Chase Young being down, that helps. Well, even before Chase Young went down. You know, they just beat Carolina. Are we better than Carolina? Well, the record says no right now. It's going to be a tough game. Going to be a tough game. I like Gibson. I like the way he plays. And McLaurin might be the most underrated receiver in the entire league.
Absolutely. Yeah. He is essentially their version of Devontae Adams, except that he doesn't have Aaron Rodgers throwing him the football. He has Taylor Heinicke. And he's one of those guys who's always open.
Yeah.
Always.
Always open. And if he's not, he figures it out. Like, he's a hell of a receiver, man. I really enjoy his game watching him. This could be a tough matchup, especially with us being so far depleted at corner, which wasn't a problem against Colt McCoy because he can't really zing it out there to the sidelines quite like somebody like Heinicke. Heinicke's got a live arm. He's basically like B minus Brett Favre, C plus Brett Favre.
That is the perfect description, because even when you were saying, you know, he has a kind of a gun to him, I go to the gunslinger.
Oh, yeah. He's a chucker all the way, dude. He's a total chucker. That's why he's fun to watch.
Quarterbacks who chuck it around, it makes it fun to watch.
It does. It's entertaining at the very least. But
then you also have to expect that. Yeah, that's why it's kind of a bummer that Brown's out. But Sidney Jones showed that he could get in front of the football. So this is going to be a chance for corners. Hopefully DJ Reed's back. That would be, at least if you have Jones and Reed, I feel like we have competent corners.
Well, I think this will be a game where the defense looks better than it did last week. And everybody goes, oh, well, that defensive meeting, it just made all the difference. And really, the difference is going to be is that Heinicke is more inconsistent than Colt McCoy when it comes to the dink and dunk stuff. And I think that will give the defense the advantage. The offense will have a few more opportunities. And if they can convert just a little bit, Pete making the statement that out of their 10 third downs, what, they converted three?
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, you convert three more. That's all we're looking for. Three more wins on third down. And now you're operating as one of the best teams on third down in the league. So if the defense can feast off of Heinicke's inconsistency, bottle up Gibson, which they've been pretty good against the run overall, that should give the offense a few more opportunities. And at that point, maybe they can run a screen and pick up an extra third down, two extra third downs. Maybe D. Eskridge can make a fly sweep work and pick one up. Maybe we can stay out of third and 12, where basically Gabe Jackson can't block to save his life.
Yeah, maybe they can move the ball with some consistency on first and second down, so that way it isn't third and 10, six out of those 10 times.
Right.
Because that was part of the thing of the Arizona game is that, yeah, you're bad on third down because you're facing multiple third and 10s.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It makes it really tough.
And a third and 20 where they give up and run the football at midfield. I'm done watching that. And I am so thankful that they did that in front of the Seattle fans so they could boo the crap out of Pete Carroll for making a third and 20 give up play at home when you're down, when you're 3-6 in the hole on the season and you need to try and make something happen.
Brandon, say all that again, but do it with a rant mentality because you're there. You're there. I've been catfish about this for the entire beginning of the season, about all the give up plays and not going for it on fourth and short near midfield. Come on, Brandon, feel the rage. How tired are you of seeing Travis Homer on third and 20?
I'm tired of it. Get him off the team. Blow him up. Actually, I do want to blow that play up.
Yeah.
And early on in the season, I can, or if you're winning consistently, I can forgive that. If you are a winning team and you're not willing to take that risk for the sake of, but we also saw in this game that every time that Colt McCoy underthrew or overthrew a receiver near the end zone, that the refs were pulling out the flag and essentially rewarding Colt McCoy for a bad throw and setting them up on the goal line for a touchdown. Why not take that chance?
Yeah. Why not take that chance? And then also too, like, how as a defensive coordinator and a defensive player, do you not understand that that's how the league is now?
Yeah, take a risk.
I mean,
even if you only get 15 yards on that play, you actually are getting into field goal range.
Yeah. Yeah. Instead of having Michael Dixon punt it yet again into the freaking end zone.
Oh, well, he did. That one, I think he actually punted down inside the five, and then you had the Jamal Adams play. Maybe should have been a safety, but wasn't.
It wasn't a safety. It was close.
It was close.
But it wasn't a safety.
What? But the idea of more fumbling the ball as he's reaching it out over the goal line. Was his knee down? I don't know if it was down.
It wasn't.
And then he recovered it in the end zone.
Yeah, I don't think that's a safety, but whatever. I mean, doesn't much matter.
It didn't feel like a safety, but it. There was enough people that said, I think that should have been a safety.
I don't know, man. Maybe they know the rules better than I do, but I don't think that that was a safety. The eyeball test says no. My gut says no.
If you reach forward with the football and the football hits the ground without a knee or an elbow or an arm touching the ground, that's a fumble, right?
No, ground can't cause a fumble.
I thought the ground couldn't cause a fumble if you have another body part down.
Well, maybe that's the case. I don't know. I could just tell you this. My gut said that wasn't a safety. Didn't feel like a safety. Didn't look like a safety. Didn't smell like a safety.
The thing is that they probably called forward progress in that situation. And so the ball even being fumbled probably didn't even matter because they called it. They whistled it forward progress with him extending the ball over the goal line.
And look, how many of these crucial calls have just gone against us this year?
All of them?
Like, all of them?
Except we actually got a break. I consider it a break when an Arizona receiver has both knees down and is possessing the football, but then loses the football as he's going to the ground, not completing the process of the catch. But it felt like a break in that situation.
Yeah, it did.
Because all of those have gone against us to that point.
But those are the things that when you look back on a season, like, this just feels like a snake bit season. Like, what are the odds Russell hits his finger on a helmet and is out for 4 weeks?
Not even a helmet. It was Aaron Donald's forearm.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, it just, yeah, when Aaron Donald comes in and basically blows up your season right there, when you lose an overtime game to the Titans for, like, no reason, when you get called for holding when your offensive lineman gets freaking dump trucked, you know, like, it takes you out of scoring range. It's just happened so many times. It's just a snake bitten season. At some point, you just got to be like, all right, it's just not this year. And we've been so fortunate not to have to deal with that. But I think because of the way that the league works and the way that this team likes to play with my emotions, that my gut tells me that this is a game against the Washington football team that the Seahawks pull out. I think they're going to get 1/6 of the way to breaking my heart, starting with this week. I think they go on a run and win 6 straight and then lose the 7th and miss the playoffs. I think that's probably how this goes. And they miss it on, you know, some heartbreaking call.
You know what, though? I'd be okay with that. I even in a season where I know playoffs are not going to happen, I want to watch my team win games from here on out. It's better to win than lose. Have I not established this yet?
It's a well-established rule from the man, the myth, the legend, Brandon Schultz. But I do think that if they end up winning all those games, much like they did at the second half of last year, where they were putting together those games, and you're just like, this does not look good. Like, sure, you're winning, but this is ugly. Like, this isn't sustainable. This is a smoke show. Like, there's no sustainability to this. If they win these next 6 games like that, that's going to be disappointing. But if they do, like you suggested, and start working on some of these things to have a winning formula for 2022, and they start winning, that could look totally different. And that's going to change. Everybody's kind of playing and coaching for their job right now, except for Russ. He's the only one that gets to decide himself.
Yeah, and DK, who's under contract.
And Tyler's under contract.
Tyler's under contract, yeah.
But they're all tradable.
That's true.
If DK keeps having little emotional meltdowns, like, you can't see the team getting rid of a diva receiver, even if they seem to be really good.
In terms of, that does make me wonder if Russ continues to underperform the rest of the season, DK might be the guy who you would pull in the most draft capital for.
Oh, easily.
Young player, and then coming to the end of his rookie contract, able to get a couple first round picks.
He's physically different than everybody else. Da, 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 da.
Not that you would want to do that, but it might be your option.
Exactly. I'm going to say it like that. That does feel like the most likely trade target via other teams, because like we were talking about earlier, like, yeah, sure. As Seahawks fans, like, we have our things that we're like, yeah, we'd like that trade to go like that. Well, think about the other GMs. They're like looking up and down Seattle's roster and who's making what and what age they are. And you're like, let's see what they take for DK.
Yeah. Ask yourself, would you take 2 first round picks for DK Metcalf? And if your initial reaction is, ugh, that's kind of gross, the idea of trading away DK, probably feels about like an equitable trade.
Oh, and who was it? Joe's email where he talked about the, the draft capital given up for Jamal Adams and how it could go down as like the worst one all those trades. Well, let's be real about that. I mean, the pick last year is what, 23rd that they gave up? Okay. And you said it earlier, I think in the Ring of Honor, that you honestly believe that they're going to win enough games going down the stretch. This isn't going to be a top 10 pick for the Jets. I know it's number five right now, but I don't see it ending there. I really don't. I agree with you. I think that's a good point. So what, a mid first rounder and a late first rounder is going to be the worst trade in the history of trades for the Seahawks? I don't think so.
I suppose the argument would be that, well, if the Seahawks hadn't made that trade, they could just lose out the rest of the season and get a top five pick, which again,
if you're into tanking.
Yeah.
I hate tanking.
But I think people are into that as a strategy.
I know they are. The GMs are into that as a strategy.
Not very many GMs. Groups are into it. Not very many GMs.
Oh, it's increasing.
I suppose.
Yeah.
No, the worst trade that will go down is for Jimmy Graham. And not just because of the performance of Jimmy Graham, because Jimmy came in and was, look, he has all the tight end records in such right. a short amount of time that he was with Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why I think that one will go down as the worst is because it went against the philosophy of what Pete wanted to do, is that he went from a guy who was tough in Max Unger to a guy who was finesse in Jimmy Graham. And that changed, that went against the mindset of how he wanted to build this team.
I was hoping that your analysis of that trade would be that it was the loss of Unger was greater than the pickup of Jimmy Graham. That was the part of that trade that really was the backbreaker of it, because you're 100% right. It changed the future of this team going forward in a bigger way than I think anybody will ever admit. And it's not like Unger didn't play well for the Saints for multiple years after that.
No, he went on and he was fine. Now, I know they had concerns about injuries and that sort of thing, but and I think that took them out of just that mindset.
There's no doubt about it.
All right, let's get to the second half of the show.
Hooray.
Getting into the second half of the show. Going to be a short NFC West watch segment, as I don't know how much you want to talk about the 49ers beating the Jaguars 30-10.
Falls very much under the category of who cares, much like when we beat the Jags at the same score. They're both terrible teams right now, and screw the Niners. Like, yeah, I think that pretty much sums it up, doesn't it?
It is fun to listen to Niners fans get hyped up about their team after a Jaguars win.
Yeah, exactly. You should know better.
They should know better.
The Rams, what happened to them this week? They lost against the bye week, right? Bye week one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is funny, though, when I see that the leading rusher is Deebo Samuel, and I think, wait, isn't that guy a wide receiver?
No, I've been telling you for so long.
And that's what goes into my head. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. He's a third down back. That's who Deebo Samuel is.
I like him, though. I like his... For a 49er, I hate that I like him.
I will not go out on a limb and say something, anything like that, because it feels dirty just having it, like, those words even ruminate in my mouth for a second, like, let alone speak them. No.
No?
Gross, okay. Brandon. Gross. Icky, yeah. Icky, icky.
Well, there you go. That makes up for your John Elway comment earlier.
John Elway's been long retired. Okay? We beat him in a Super Bowl.
Yeah. And then there was another NFC West-centric game that we don't really need to talk about anymore. You know what we should talk about is how much money we're making. We're bringing it in hand over fist with our gambling winnings this year, Adam.
Yeah. Hey, I'm starting to understand why people do this gambling thing in terms of if your team is not so much in it. I get it. It gives you something else.
I don't know if we could call this the stone cold lock of the week, but maybe like the limp noodle lock of the week, because we do things like take the Lions plus 17.5 points.
Yeah, I would say Brandon and Adams, low risk, minimum reward propositions.
It has a ring to it.
Yeah, I mean, it really does. Have some t-shirts made up.
So where are we going to go?
What are our options this week? Yeah, okay. What are we looking at?
Well, if we want to have fun on Thanksgiving, we have three Thanksgiving games. Chicago at Detroit. Although the thing is, if this episode comes out on Thanksgiving and people decide to push it back because they're hanging with their families, picking one of these Thanksgiving games, it's not going to help out anybody else.
I'm going to make this easy for you. Thursday games are a big stay away for me.
Okay. Always a big stay away in terms of just your gambling philosophy.
Yes.
I think that's fair. Looking at Sunday early games, Tampa at Indy, Jets at Houston, Philly at New York, the Giants, Carolina at Miami. Ooh, that could be a fun one. You hate the Dolphins. Pittsburgh at Cincy, Atlanta at Jacksonville, Tennessee at New England. Those are your morning games.
I guess, are there any lines that are interesting? What is the Panthers-Dolphins line?
Carolina -2.
Is it in Miami?
Yes. It almost feels like a Miami game that you'd want to pick the Dolphins.
Yeah, well, I have standards, so no.
Okay. Well, you know what? You should stay away from the emotional ones anyway, because you're always going to be picking with your heart in those types of situations.
Right, which isn't always wrong, but
no, you know. It's not.
All right, none of those really jumped out.
The one line that's interesting to me is New England -6.5 against the Tennessee Titans. Tennessee had one bad week, and it's -6.5 for a team led by a rookie.
I really, really don't know what to make of the Titans. I can't tell you if they're a very good team or a mediocre team without Derrick Henry. I can't tell you. The Titans are a team that I do not want to bet on or against.
Then there's Tampa, who is only favored by 3 against Indy, but that is in Indy. So maybe that makes sense.
That one, I kind of like that one. So let's put a pin in Tampa, Indy, because Indy's had a couple good games and Jonathan Taylor's had a few big games. They're due for a Carson Wentz letdown. Like, it's just coming.
It does.
And it's Tom Brady.
Rams at Green Bay is a pick'em.
That's a pick'em?
It's a pick'em.
Okay.
Feels like Green Bay should win by points.
Oh, yeah. I feel like that's Green Bay by 2 scores, but that's... Ooh,
that could be an emotional one.
No, I genuinely can't stand Aaron Rodgers in... I mean, I don't know. Maybe with his COVID toe, like, they're totally screwed. I have no idea.
Maybe, but he played fine. He didn't look like he was being hampered by a toe.
No, hey, look, I just found out today that it's legit COVID toe.
Is it legit COVID toe? Thing.
That's what it is. It's called COVID toe. Apparently, it's a...
Well, I've heard indicator of COVID toe, but I know that Aaron Rodgers... I thought, are they covering up the fact that he was asymptomatic ahead of the Seahawks game then? Because having COVID toe seems like a COVID symptom.
Yes. Yep, it does. Apparently, it's a marker of a strong immune response. That there's too much of one of your immune response thingies and it goes to your toes.
Well, there you go. Aaron Rodgers should not have played in that game against the Seahawks. They should forfeit that. We should switch the amount of draft picks that we have and we should get their wins.
Okay. Hey, look, Commissioner,
it's only
Schultz.
Fair. I'm just trying to come up with a fair punishment so that...
You do what you need to do, Commissioner.
All right. So that one's interesting. Got San Francisco favored by 3 against the Vikings.
Oh, there it is. That's the one.
Wow. That is wild.
I'll take the Vikings in the points. You betcha.
How many points?
Well, they're getting 3 right now, right? What does that look like for a $12 bet? What do we get if we win? Because this must be in Santa Clara.
It is in Santa Clara.
Like, it matters. I know Tart's coming back, but... none of those people are going to be able to cover Justin Jefferson.
The line right now is 3.5.
I'll take 3.5 points, 100%.
$12 bet. You bet 12, you get 29, so you're profiting of 17.
You know it's going to be less than a touchdown that game. You know it's going to be. And I genuinely think that Minnesota is the better team by like a significant margin. That's a good return on investment. I like that a lot.
All right. Yeah, I can go with that.
Because even if Captain Anti-Clutch comes through in Cousins, I mean, you still got other Captain Anti-Clutch, Admiral Anti-Clutch, and freaking Garoppolo on the other side of the ball.
And this isn't in prime time. This is just Sunday afternoon.
Yeah. Yeah.
San Francisco has won one game at home this year.
Mm-hmm. It's going to stay there.
And it was against the team that they always beat every single year in the Rams.
Yeah.
They've got everybody fooled after beating the Rams and beating the Jaguars to thinking that they actually deserve to have to be favored at home against a Vikings team.
Yep, absolutely not.
There you go.
I can tell you one of those teams has been far more consistent this year than the other.
What do you say we welcome some new members of the flock? If you want to get in the flock, you can go to getintheflock.com. If you support at the $90 and above level, you get to be one of our executive producers like DCH, Dustin Mock, Brian Shaw, and Kevin Watterson. And coming in for the rest of this month as an executive producer for giving us a donation for the entire year at 12 and above is Brian Barlow, who came in with $144 for an annual donation.
So Brian is definitely a baller because it's hard to make a donation like that during a season like this. Like for all of you who are still, you know, making your monthly contributions to being in the flock, to everybody who's new getting into the flock every week, like if you do it this year, you are gangster. Like that's you're one of the best listeners we can have. All the folks that are still in the flock, you know, with this season going the way it is, you guys are OG gangsters. And like this, I'm just blown away by all you guys and your effort and your support.
It's true, because one of the things that every time the Seahawks lose, it's like, oh my gosh, everybody's going to stop being a fan of this team. They're going to say, right? Screw this podcast. I'm withdrawing my donation. Then the show's going to go away. And yeah, it's a consistent thought in my mind with every loss. And it's people like Brian coming through with the annual donation that brings me hope that I don't have to worry about that.
I guess we don't. It hasn't seemed to be the case. And you know, let's see how many people freak out and be like, oh, you mentioned firing somebody or trading somebody. You hate the Seahawks. You're not even a real fan because you have criticisms of the team.
It may be. I feel like sometimes it goes the other way, though, that we aren't talking about people being fired enough.
I think we're just measured and careful before we start calling for people's jobs because it's, you know, their livelihood.
Brian comes in with an email, says, I opted for the $12 per month plan, but I just gave it all to you in one fell swoop. I'm not an X's and O's guy, and I don't participate in the social media discussions, but I drive thousands of miles per week, and your Field Goals podcast and your Seahawkers discussions help keep me sane. However, I do have opinions and make observations, like this one that is bugging me, but you didn't ask for. I would suggest that if you want to understand the difference between early Pete Carroll, John Schneider player acquisition success versus the latter dismal failures, you need to look no further than the death of Paul Allen. In the first couple of post-Super Bowl years, when they began to draft later in rounds, there were a few busts, but that's nothing compared to the career they have seemingly made of bad choices since Paul Allen died and took with him the only check on Pete Carroll's autonomy. Seemingly, almost every choice since Paul Allen passed has been some form of reclamation project. Pete became convinced of his ability to coax more and more out of broken or damaged players or players with chips on their shoulders. He decided he was the catalyst for channeling Richard Sherman's rage or Marshawn Lynch finally finding his groove, so he began to look for those players. It seems he would rather take someone of less talent, granted they have some sort of something to overcome. That is not something a general manager would do. That's something Pete Carroll would do. If you don't agree with me, then please explain Trey Flowers. What was he, a surprise gift? Hey, Pete, I know you want a corner to replace Richard Sherman, but check out this fifth-round safety conversion project I've got for you. Hell no! That is 100% a pick made by a coach with the conviction that he is some sort of secondary whisperer who can mold MVPs out of raw clay. No GM ever gifted a coach with a conversion project. Want to understand why Pete has granted so many chances to players like Rasheem Green, too young, or Penny, small school, or why he doubled down on the Adams contract? Because he chose them. If Schneider had chosen them, Delano Hill, Jimmy Graham, Alex Collins, the first time, they'd be long gone. Pete Carroll is tanking our drafts the same way he tanks much of the offensive play calling because he can't stop interfering. Sorry for the rant. From Brian.
Brian, never apologize for a solid rant. Never apologize. Now, I will disagree slightly here because correlation does not necessarily prove causation.
I don't think Paul Allen passing has anything to do with it, but I think there's
a... I really don't. Yeah.
I think you're onto something in terms of the philosophy.
Well, I guess I would say, all right, so when you talk about the corners, right, and he's like, oh, the Trey Flowers part of it, you know, try to explain that. Well, okay, they drafted Shaq Griffin in the third?
Third, yeah.
Yeah.
He was the highest drafted cornerback that Pete Carroll's ever taken.
Okay, right. And then how many draft picks did they have above a third rounder over the last 3-4 years?
I've had a few.
Almost always a second rounder, right?
Almost always, yeah.
Yeah, that's it. There hasn't been a lot of first round picks because John Schneider has been trading them away in big blockbuster trades. Right. So if you're saying that, you know, Pete is like, no, I will only accept DBs picked in the third round or later so that I can build them up for my ego, I don't buy it. I think that's just been a byproduct of the other avenues that they have gone through for roster building. Now, if you want to say it's all Pete on the Jimmy Graham trade, it's all Pete on the Percy Harvin trade, it's all Pete on the Jamal Adams trade, okay, maybe. But we don't know that. We really don't. We have no idea exactly how much of it is Pete and how much of it is John. We just don't.
No, but I think it's fair to look at some of these hints. And I can see why it would lead Brian to believe that Pete's behind those moves.
It's a plausible theory. It's just, I guess I hear a lot of folks, and I'm not talking about Brian. I'm talking about a lot of other folks that are outspoken about the team. And they seem to have a deep and intimate knowledge of the inner workings of the team and the power structure and how it all exactly goes down. And they speak on it as if it's like absolute gospel fact. And they just don't know. They have ideas. They have gut feels. That's cool. But sure, they speak about it like it's an indisputable fact.
Well, even national guys like Colin Cowherd, who, you know, everybody has their theories on who his insider people are to give him information. Mm-hmm. He's only getting it through certain channels. So he's getting the perspective of those people. And it can be skewed, too. So, yeah, the only people who know are the people who are actually in the building.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we can speculate, and I think as long as you frame it in terms of, I think this is how this works, then that's okay. But and I'm not accusing Brian of this at all. I mean, I thought his email had some interesting theories, but I think we just need to keep them as theories.
Yes, and I think that's what Brian was getting at. So,
oh, absolutely. Like, yeah. I said, I'm not trying to accuse Brian of that. It just brought me to a different point.
Well, appreciate Brian coming in. And like I said, if you want to get in the flock, you can go to getintheflock.com. You can also go to tinypiecesofseahawksstuff.com. It's a Russell Wilson Tools of the Trade card with got a little piece of football in there. You got a piece of jersey. It's a fun little card. You can check it out. tinypiecesofseahawksstuff.com.
Does it have a little piece of his finger splint?
No, this was before the injury. So this was, let's see, 2018. That would be pretty wild, though, because it says the enclosed player used material is guaranteed by Panini America. What if they chopped up the finger pin as a player used item and put it into a card?
Look, I know people are all about getting them checks, and I can't believe it hasn't happened yet.
What we need it to be is preserved so that when Russell Wilson rattles off a perfect streak of games for the rest of this season and then goes on to hold up the Lombardi this season, then that can be what is, you've got to put that in the Hall of Fame display.
There you go. Yeah. Maybe that's what, who's the equipment manager? It's Kennedy, right? Last name's Kennedy.
Yeah. Eric.
Yes. Yep. That's what he's holding on to it for. That's why he hasn't sold it off yet.
That's why.
Yeah. That's his retirement check right there. Russell's finger splint in the
most why does the equipment manager get Russell Wilson's finger pin?
Who else is in charge of the equipment?
I don't think that's equipment, though.
How is that not equipment?
I think of equipment as like footballs, you know, the little tee that you put the football on.
Are shoulder pads equipment?
Yes.
Oh, and so shoulder pads are something you put on your body to protect your shoulders, right? So Russ put something on his finger to protect his finger.
Oh, no, I was talking about the pin that they inserted into his finger while it healed.
Oh, no, that's something totally different. That's weird. If you're starting to sell off like surgically implanted things, then no. I'm talking about the splint he wore last week.
Oh, fair enough. Okay, good. Yeah. Now I feel better. Now I'm on the same page with you. Yes, that's equipment.
Okay. All right. Yeah, that's equipment.
And I do want that in a card. The medical thing, I don't want to have anything to do with that.
No, you don't want anything that I like player use things, maybe not things that were inside of their body. Like, I think that's where the line is.
I do think both deserve to be in Canton, though.
Okay. Maybe side by side.
Yeah.
And then right next to the Lombardi from this year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Welcome to the delusional fan part of the Seahawkers podcast. This is great.
I can still be delusional and have fantasies for this
Absolutely.
Season. Absolutely. Don't take that away from me.
Hey, I threw out my fantasy of them winning this game and being 1/6 of the way to breaking my heart at the end of the year.
Yeah, it could happen.
Or they win all 7 games and miss by half a game.
Maybe. Quick look at the Pick'em League standings. Now, I haven't yet gone through here to check that people are holding by the rules of the league and picking the Seahawks to win every single week. Mm-hmm. So help me. If I announce you as a winner on the show and I go back and I check and find out that you picked against our Seahawks.
Wrath.
Banned. You are banned.
Woo. Woo. Commissioner Brandon is not catfish around, guys. Like, you better get your poop in a group.
Hey, if you need me to take out my frustrations on something, it will be a Pick'em League. And if you're picking against our team, which is a stated rule, I've given warnings in previous shows right here in this segment.
Right.
And I haven't yet brought the hammer down.
So I'm curious as to how excited Barry is regarding this week, because he gets basically a pretty good shot at being up on everybody because he's the one dude. That, especially in this game, right?
I cannot take that away from Barry, the football team. He gets to pick his team, but he's going to be wrong this week, so it doesn't even matter. Like, I'm fine with him picking his team because the Seahawks are going to win, and then he's going to have to take the L.
Yeah, well, that will be fun. I hope Barry's ready for that.
I know Unlimited Hakra is ready to take the helm of the first place position in the standings. Because that's where Unlimited Hakra is with 106 points ahead of Honey Hole Hawk and Peaceful Easily Feeling back at number 2.
Making a rally.
So there's your top 3. And then the winner this week with 12 picks correct. 12! See, this...
Apropos.
Well, but it has me worried. Could you see Bayou Hawk getting 12 picks correct, but also picking against the Seahawks and then getting 12 right? Should I look this up right now? Should we see if I need to do a live banning of a team on the show?
How do you not think that I'm 1,000,000% on board on a public call out and doing this live and for fun? What makes you think I'd be against this in any way? I love every part of this.
Okay. Let's go to Bayou Hawks picks. View all picks. One thing about the CBS site is that it generally can be slow. It makes doing stuff like this
in real time. That's fine. You know what this is doing? It's buying me the time for my Apple News app that takes forever to bring up saved stories so that I have something for my better at life. So this whole, slow technology thing is going hand in hand right now. It's working out for me.
I have good news. Bayou Hawk is the winner and not banned from the Seahawkers Podcast Pick'em League. Congratulations on the week. What week is it? Week 11 victory.
I love it because I wanted to have faith, and that faith was rewarded. And Bayou Hawk obviously knows exactly what's up. He knows the rules, does the right thing, or she, whoever Bayou Hawk is. They're great. They're great people is what I'm getting.
Bayou Hawk is a great Seahawks fan.
Yes.
And the winner with 12 picks correct. He still had Mrs. Doug Baldwin there with 11 picks correct. Bridget got 11 right. Good job, shit. Bridget.
Okay.
Marlon Briner, I dig a good quandary, and I need flowers to wags my Dixon.
Oh, that was fabulous. I love that.
That's a good team name right there. All right. Well, no public banning this week. Tune in next week. No, you won't have to tune in next week because the Seahawks are going to win. So everybody that picks the Seahawks will be correct.
That's exactly right.
All right. On to do better and better at life.
All right, man. My do better this week is for color commentator Jonathan Vilma, who literally enraged me in the middle of the game this last week. Doing the color commentary, Russell Wilson hits Tyler Lockett deep down the right sideline after a broken play and a scramble drill where Tyler gets out close to the the sideline. And he immediately jumps into this idea that Tyler had gone out of bounds and then was the first dude to touch the ball. And he was so in on this. And then they finally pull up the replay, right? And it's like from the above camera, like up above. And he's like, look, he steps out right there. Number one, there's green around his entire foot. Number two, the other foot, if that's what he's trying to imply, is covered up by like three dudes. You couldn't see Jack. And for him, from the very beginning, and then he gets the play-by-play guy to go along with him. Oh, yeah, well, geez, you know, I mean, that's a tough break. And I can't believe the officials didn't see that. And they are talking about the idea that Tyler stepped out of bounds before he got that ball, as if it's a stone cold fact that is indisputable that we all saw in the replay. And holy smokes, I can't believe the Seahawks are getting away with this. I just couldn't believe it. And they went on and on and on about it. It pissed me off so freaking much as I was sitting in my hotel room. I was so mad. Jonathan Vilma, get your poop in a group. Don't talk about stuff that you don't know as a fact, as if it's a fact. Do better.
Do better. See, I was looking down, watching our chat room stuff and just listening at this point. And I was convinced that Tyler had done something wrong. And I hear from you, they're like, no, even then the replay showed. But he was so convinced that I just, without seeing it, I figured that he was telling the truth.
Yeah. Yeah. He the way that he talked about it, he was so freaking certain and you couldn't tell at all. And not only that, if you really looked at it, it looked as if he was dead ass wrong. Like if I had to hedge my bet, because I can't say it for a certainty either, but if I was going to hedge my bet, it looked like he did not go out of bounds. And then on top of that, the referee didn't think he went out of bounds. But yet Jonathan Vilma from 70 yards away with a crap replay on top of it has just decided that, oh yeah, I mean, the Seahawks got lucky there. Like one of our only good plays.
Thanks a lot, Jonathan.
Do better.
We need those big plays. Do better.
Yeah. Yeah.
My do better this week, I'm giving it to Pete Carroll for walking out of his press conference. I've never seen Pete do that. And yeah, it wasn't like it was like Tom Brady where he's like, keep this short and then bailed out in just 1 minute. No, he was there for a good 7, 8, 9 minutes before he bailed. But all these people giving him credit for coming back. No, you hold Pete's feet to the fire. He shouldn't have walked out in the first place. Coach, do better.
I like to see that he was frustrated and that this wasn't going the way that he wanted and that like that it bothered him. I liked it. And then on top of that, give him credit for coming back. Your do better's wrong. Now, if you want to do better, Pete, for playing the most vanilla defense of all time, then okay. But for showing a little frustration.
I can sense the frustration from him through his answers. Like, I can tell that Pete Carroll's frustrated. He didn't need to walk out of the press conference for me to know that he felt frustrated.
It's not like he Cam Newton's his press conferences all the time.
No. And I thought it was important for him to come back and recognize that he respects the reporters. And that was good. Yeah. It was unnecessary. He didn't need to do it.
Are you the necessary police when it comes to how long you stay or don't stay in press conferences?
Are you the do better police that gets to say which one of my do betters is appropriate or not?
The better at life part has always been yours. You're the creator of that. The do better ended up kind of being my creation. So
do better to the Hall of Fame committee for excluding Sean Alexander among their 26 modern era semifinalists for the class of 2022. I want to see Sean Alexander among those five. You can't tell me that there's 26 players more deserving of a Hall of Fame class for this year that Sean Alexander doesn't at least deserve to be part of the group of 26 that it comes down to. No, they should be in there. Do better.
See, there you go. You've recovered nicely with your backup. Do better. That's a quality do better right there.
Well, I was trying to decide if I wanted to do better at life for, you know, guys like Ricky Waters and Devin Hester, you know, good former Seahawks. Well, you know, Ricky Waters, probably you could probably actually include him as a true former Seahawks legend.
Yeah.
But you got Devin Hester in there as a finalist. You know who is not in here, though, is the defensive tackle played for the Vikings for most of his career and then played like the last 2 years. Kevin Williams.
Oh, OK. Yeah.
He's not a finalist.
I wouldn't think of him as a Hall of Famer. Yeah, I think he'd be in the hall. He'd be in the Hall of Very Good. And that's kind of where I'd put Sean Alexander as well. He'd be in the Hall of Very Good to me.
I guarantee you I can find dudes on this list that you think should be, that Sean Alexander should be there ahead of him for this list of 26 finalists. I'm not going to go through them all, though. I want to see Ricky Waters get in.
You know, I like Ricky Waters a ton. He's one of my more favorite backs that the Seahawks have ever had. Again, he's in the Hall Very Good to me.
Devin Hester's got to get in, though, right?
Oh, absolutely. As a return man, I mean, he was the best of the best for a decade. Like, I think that's how you kind of measure these things. Were you one of the three best dudes for a decade at your position? If you were, or close to, then yeah, you're a Hall of Famer.
All right, on to better at life.
All right, man. My better at life than Skip Bayless this week, surprise, surprise, is space related and also shooting things related. And so this story like combines like all of the things that I love the most in one story. So NASA is shooting off its first test of hitting an asteroid with a satellite to knock it off course so it doesn't collide with Earth.
Ooh, that's fun.
This asteroid wasn't going to collide with us or anything, but they're trying to figure out how to not have a Bruce Willis moment, you know, from Armageddon. Like, they're trying to like prevent that years out, right?
Yeah, because we don't want to have to send astronauts to land on the asteroid to blow it up from space. We want to see if we can do it from ground first.
Yeah, like out ahead of time, have some foresight and stuff, you know, like I think it's pretty cool. And because they're trying to keep us from becoming dinosaurs, you know, where we all just die from an asteroid and then
that'd be ideal. I don't want to go the way of the dinosaurs.
Years later, another species pumps us out of the ground and burns us for energy. So like, I love the fact that they're trying to prevent us from that fate. It's going to be really fun. The mission is called DART. It's a small spacecraft. They're going to try to hit this asteroid, knock it off course just a little bit, make sure that they can do it just in case that we ever have to do it for real. Now, here's conspiracy theory, Adam, that will come out with this better at life is that maybe this is the real asteroid that's coming to get us in. They won't tell us. And this is our last ditch effort to try to save humanity. Maybe that's happening right now. Either way, I'm glad they're doing something better at life than Skip Bayless for NASA and the DART mission.
Now, if this really was the mission, wouldn't you also want to test out your messaging to make sure that, I don't know. I guess you don't want to get people all wound up for no reason.
Yeah. See, this is where conspiracy theory, Adam, comes out, right? Because if we really were in danger and they really were sending a mission to knock an asteroid off course so that we all don't turn into, you know, dead dinosaurs, then would you really announce it to the public? Or would you be like, hey, guys, check it out. We're going to test one out. Just see what's up.
With the online community, we would have enough scientists that would be willing to go against the grain to let us know that their calculations are correct. Even the amateur astronomers, I think, would let us know. But would we believe them?
I don't know, Brandon. I mean, geez Louise. I mean, all these people also can't seem to figure out that the Earth is flat and that we've never been to the moon. So,
but you know what? The benefit of being a flat earther is that you never have to worry about asteroids.
Well, I don't know. It depends on what plane they're coming in from, right? Like, it's hard to shoot a paper plate when it's, you know, on edge, but it's really easy to hit one when it's, you know, flat and looking at you.
Yeah, but, you know, that's a good question. That's a question for hey, flat earthers, if you're still listening to this show, do you concern yourself with asteroids?
That's a great question.
Email in gohawks@seahawkerspodcast.com.
This is a can of worms I can't believe we just opened up, but here we go.
My better at life this week is for our members of the flock. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
That's it.
You guys
are better at life than Skip Bayless.
Look, I know I'm not the guy to be able to, what was I calling myself for the do better section? The decider of like,
yeah, the do better police.
Yeah. The do better police. And I know I'm not the better at life than Skip Bayless police, but if I were, I would say you nailed it this week. That was awesome, dude.
Hey, when the holidays are here, thinking of things that I'm thankful for, it's our members of the flock. So I will honor you, especially this time of year, with that honorary better at life than Skip Bayless moniker.
Yeah, and I really do hope that you guys all enjoy the hands down easiest, it's easily stated and provable that it's the best holiday in all of the American holidays, Thanksgiving. I hope you really do enjoy it.
And with that,
there's only one thing left to say.
Go Hawks.
Go Hawks.